Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Mysterious Benedict Society. The next chapter is called The Sender and the Messages. In the end, every child agreed to join the team, though the decision was more difficult for some than others. Kate took out a stick of gum and said, "I'm in," without even pausing to consider. Rainey, less fearless than Kate, had to give the matter some thought. If he didn't join the team, what would he do? Return to the orphanage? Seeing Miss Perumal again would be nice, but he would be in the same pickle as before, out of place among the other children, purposeless and lonely. Moreover, if Mr. Benedict was to be trusted, and for some reason Rainey did trust him, then feeling purposeless and lonely were the least of his problems. Something terrible was happening, and Mr. Benedict needed them to stop it. A strange sense of duty, not to mention a powerful curiosity, compelled him to join. Constance was more skeptical. It was becoming clear that this was her natural approach to things.
"So if I stick around and you tell me this big secret, what's to stop me from going out and telling everyone?"
"Nothing will stop you," said Mr. Benedict. "You're free to leave at any time. However, if I hadn't determined I could trust you, you would never have been invited into this room. And for that matter, even if you were to tell, no one would believe you, for you are only a child. Is that not why you came to take these tests in the first place?"
Constance's face screwed up as if she might burst into tears, or, more likely, throw a screaming fit.
"I don't mean to attack you, child," Mr. Benedict said gently. "Let us strike a bargain. If you join the team, this shall be our understanding. You will follow my instructions, but only because you have agreed to do so, not because I told you to. No one is making you do anything. It is all of your own free will."
"Fine," Constance said at last. "Now where do we sleep?"
"I know you're tired, but first we must wait for Sticky to make up his mind."
Sticky had been shrinking in his chair. He had drawn his feet up beneath him, crossed his arms over his knees, and buried his face behind them. At Mr. Benedict's words, he looked up with an expression of something like panic, then quickly hid his face again. His voice muffled, his words mumbled. Sticky said,
"May I make the decision tomorrow?"
"I'm afraid not, my friend. There's no time to waste. I hate to press you, but you must decide tonight."
"Do you think the team is good enough without me?"
came the muffled voice.
"Frankly, no. I think the team needs you to succeed."
"Then how can I say no?"
Mr. Benedict spoke gently.
"Sticky, it's quite reasonable for you to be afraid. It's a terrible thing for a child to be asked to join a dangerous mission. You have every reason to say no, and I will not blame you in the least."
"Come on, Sticky," said Kate. "It'll be fun."
Sticky peeked out from behind his knees, first at Kate, who gave him a smile and a wink, then at Rainey, who said,
"I'm with Mr. Benedict. I don't blame you if you don't join us, but I'd feel a whole lot better if you did."
"You would?"
Rainey nodded. Sticky hid his face again. For a long time, the room was silent, full of expectation. Although Constance yawned and scratched at an insect bite on her ankle, no one else moved or spoke a word. There was only the hushed sound of their breathing, and, from somewhere in the room, the ticking of a clock, which must have been hidden by books. Finally, Sticky looked up.
"I'll do it. Now, may I please use the bathroom?"
Much as the children had longed for more answers, it had grown late, their eyes were heavy, and Mr. Benedict deemed they should rest tonight and leave further explanations for morning. In short order, they were given toothbrushes, pajamas, and warm slippers. It was drafty in the old house at night, and shown to their rooms. The bedroom Rainey shared with Sticky was small but comfortable, with a worn rug on the wooden floor, bunk beds against the wall, and, of course, more bookshelves. When Rainey returned from brushing his teeth, he found Sticky already asleep on the lower bunk, the lamp still lit, spectacles still on his nose, and slippers still on his feet. On his chest, rising and falling with the deep, regular breaths of a solid sleeper, lay a thick book about tropical plant life that he'd taken from a shelf. It was open to the very middle. In only a few minutes, Sticky had read half the book. Rainey marveled at this. He was a fast reader himself, faster than most adults, but compared to Sticky, he must seem positively sluggish. Such an incredible gift. And yet here the boy lay, a runaway, sleeping in a stranger's house. What had he run from? Standing there in the lamplit room, reflecting upon Sticky's life as he slept, Rainey experienced a curious mixture of admiration, affection, and sympathy. Curious because although he'd known the boy for only a day, it seemed as if they'd been friends for ages. And Kate, too, he reflected. He was already quite fond of her. And Constance, well, with Constance, he would have to wait and see. Anyway, Rainey thought, if nothing else comes of this, at least you're making friends. That's more than you had yesterday. He eased Sticky slippers from his feet and his glasses from his nose, setting them, along with the plant book, upon a bedside stand. Then he drew a cover over his friend, turned off the lamp, and crept from the room. Down the dark, quiet hall, the girls must have been asleep too, and down a flight of creaky stairs, Rainey made his way back to Mr. Benedict's study. He knocked softly on the door, and from within, a voice called, "Please come in, Rainey." Rainey entered to find Mr. Benedict alone in the room, seated on the floor with his back against the desk, surrounded by books, papers, and a variety of colored pens. He gestured toward a chair and said, "Have a seat, will you, while I clear some of this away." He began sorting things into piles. "Awkward business, working on the floor, but that is my compromise with Rhonda and Number Two. They've grown overprotective, I'm afraid, and can hardly stand to leave me alone for a minute. Thus, I promise them to remain seated as much as possible, and on the floor when possible, and in turn they allow me some occasional privacy." Mr. Benedict finished tidying his things and sat in a chair across from Rainey. "I've been expecting you. I imagine you wish to call Miss Perumal and apprise her of your situation." Rainey nodded. "You're very good to think of it. Number Two told me how you resisted her attempts to befuddle you on the same matter earlier today. I assume you realize her deceptions were another aspect of the testing?" Again, Rainey nodded. He hadn't known it at the time, but looking back on the encounter later, he had suspected as much. "You behaved admirably," Mr. Benedict said. "Polite, but steadfast, and with appropriate consideration. Now, I'm afraid you can't make your telephone call this time, either, but it has nothing to do with being tested. As it happens, Miss Perumal phoned while you were being shown to your room. Her mother, it seems, has had an unfortunate reaction to her new medicine, and Miss Perumal found it necessary to take her to the hospital. She begs you not to worry. It's only a mild reaction, and the doctors assure her that her mother will be spry as a robin come morning. But she wanted you to know how proud she is of you. Proud, but not surprised, she said, and sends you her best regards. And now," he continued, removing his spectacles and looking frankly at Rainey with his bright green eyes. They were made greener still by his green plaid suit. "I will anticipate your other questions. First, I've made all the necessary arrangements with Mr. Rutger at the orphanage. We have considerable skills and resources here, and can do many things you might not expect. And second, on a more solemn note, no, you won't be able to contact Miss Perumal again. I'm afraid the urgency of our mission and its necessary secrecy forbids it. It is for Miss Perumal's protection, as well as your own."
But if all goes well, which is, of course, our most desperate hope, you will see her again. Indeed, if our mission is to succeed, it must do so very quickly. And so, with luck, your reunion will be sooner rather than later. Rainey nodded again, though not quite as bravely as before, and glanced away to hide the tears in his eyes. He had thought this might be the case, but it still saddened him to think that he might not ever again share a cup of tea with Miss Perumal, or attempt to tell her, in his limited Tamil, about his adventures. He was sad at the thought of what lay ahead, yes, and more than a little afraid.
"I am sorry, Rainey," said Mr. Benedict with a quaver in his voice.
Rainey didn't look at him just yet. He kept his eyes averted until he had composed himself, which he did with a few deep breaths and a quick swipe at his tearful eyes. When he felt sufficiently recovered, he turned back to Mr. Benedict, who was sound asleep in his chair. Before Rainey could rise and tiptoe from the room, however, Mr. Benedict's eyes popped open, and he laid a hand on Rainey's arm to stop him.
"Forgive me," he said, clearing his throat and running his fingers through his unkempt hair. "Please stay just a moment longer. I wanted to ask you something. I wasn't asleep long, was I? I trust I haven't kept you up?"
"No, sir, only a minute or two."
"Ah, good. Usually it is only a minute or two, but occasionally it's longer. Now then, for my question."
"Yes, sir?"
"It regards the chess problem from the first test. You, Rainey, happen to be the only child ever to answer the question correctly, and I should like to hear your explanation for it. The board clearly shows that only the black pawn is out of its starting position, while all the other pieces and pawns rest on their original squares. Yet, according to the rules of chess, the white player always moves first. Why, then, did you say the position was possible?"
"Because the white knight may have changed its mind."
"The white knight?"
"Oh, yes, sir. The pawns can only move forward, never backward. So none of the white pawns could have moved yet. And the bigger pieces are trapped behind the pawns, because only knights can jump over things, so they couldn't have moved yet either. But a white knight might have opened the game by jumping out in front. Then, after the black pawn was moved, the knight returned to its original square. So it looks like the white player never moved at all."
"Bravo, Rainey. You're quite correct. Now tell me, would you consider this a good move?"
"I'm no great chess player, but I would say not. By starting over, white loses the advantage of going first."
"Why, then, do you think the white player might have done it?"
Rainey considered. He imagined himself moving out his knight, only to bring it right back to where it had started. Why would he ever do such a thing? At last, he said,
"Perhaps because he doubted himself."
"Indeed," said Mr. Benedict. "Perhaps he did. Thank you, Rainey. You've been very kind and very patient, and I'm sure you're ready for a night's sleep. I'll see you at breakfast, bright and early."
Rainey rose and went to the door, but there he hesitated. He looked back. Mr. Benedict had replaced his spectacles and lowered himself onto the floor again, was again leaning against the desk, and had taken up a book. His eyebrows rose expectantly when he noticed the boy lingering.
"Yes, Rainey?"
"Mr. Benedict, sir, have you read all the books in this house?" Mr. Benedict smiled, glancing fondly about at the many books in his study, before looking at Rainey again.
"My dear boy," he said, "what do you think?"
"Bright and early," Mr. Benedict had said, and indeed it was early, but it was far from bright. As the children rose and went down to the dining room, not knowing where else to meet, rain was slashing against the windows, wind groaned in the chimneys, and odd drafts sent papers flying from desktops and skittering across floors. The blackened sky outside seemed to creep gloomily into the house, dimming the lamps and lengthening their shadows.
and along with the howling chimneys was heard the growling of thunder, low and menacing and close at hand, as if a tiger prowled the dark rooms beyond their walls. From time to time, the lamps flickered with the thunder, and once, just as the children were taking seats at the table, they went out entirely. The room was dark, only for a few moments, yet when the lamps came back to life, Milligan stood before the children with a pitcher of juice, having appeared out of nowhere. Constance shrieked, the other children jumped. Milligan sighed. Filling their juice glasses, he said, "Rhonda's coming with toast and eggs. Number 2's stopping a leak in her bedroom wall, but she'll fetch Mr. Benedict when she's done." "Milligan, may I have some milk, please?" Kate asked cheerily. She'd been awake longer than anyone, had already bathed and dressed in the fresh clothes Rhonda had given her, and, apparently unaffected by the storm, was in a much better mood than the others. Without doubt, she was in a better mood than Milligan, who nodded glumly and said, "Anything else?"
"You wouldn't have any tea, would you, Milligan?" asked Rainey. "And perhaps a little honey?"
"And candy?" asked Constance.
"No candy for breakfast," Milligan said, leaving the room.
Rhonda appeared with a tray of wheat, toast, eggs, and fruit.
"Good morning, everyone," she said. "Quite a bit of weather we're having, isn't it? On a day like this, you have to set something on every stray sheet of paper if you don't want a draft carrying it off. A map of Stonetown Harbor passed me in the hall just now. And on the stairs, I found a grocery list I misplaced 2 weeks ago."
"Leaks in the walls and drafts in every room," Constance grumbled. "You should have these things fixed."
"Leaks and drafts aren't priorities, I'm afraid," Rhonda said. "Our project, which is now your project too, has required every spare moment, and all our resources have gone toward the research, the investigation, and the tests. Constance, will you pass the juice pitcher, please?"
"No," the girl replied, crossing her arms.
"Perhaps you'll be less cranky after you've eaten," Rhonda said, getting the pitcher herself. At this, Constance's pudgy, rosy cheeks grew redder still, so that her wispy blonde hair seemed almost white in contrast, and her pale blue eyes shone bright as stars. Rhonda noticed this and said, "Constance, I had no idea how lovely your eyes were until just now. They're spectacular." This compliment, somehow upsetting to Constance, kept her quiet for some time. Milligan returned with the milk, a pot of tea, and a jar of honey. Mumbling something to Rhonda about being on duty, he left without another word.
"What does he mean by that?" Sticky said. "On duty."
"Milligan is our, for a lack of a better word, our bodyguard. He has other tasks, but his first duty is to make sure we're safe. Of course, until now, we haven't been in direct danger, but now that you're here, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to alarm you. The important thing is he's here to protect you."
"Protect us from what?" Rainey asked.
"I'll let Mr. Benedict explain all that when he comes down. The main rule is this. You must never leave the house without Milligan's company. Inside the house, you're quite safe. We have defenses here. The maze, for example, wasn't just a test. It's the only entrance. And this reminds me. All the arrows in the maze point to the stairway, which isn't helpful if you're trying to leave the house. That's another reason you should never go without Milligan. We have a special way of opening the front door. You'll remember it has no inside knob, and Milligan knows the maze like the back of his hand."
"I've always thought that was a funny expression," Kate said, "because how well do people really know the backs of their hands? Honestly, can anyone here tell me exactly what the back of your hand looks like?"
They were all contemplating the backs of their hands when Mr. Benedict came in, followed very closely and attentively by Number 2, who no longer wore her yellow suit, but had changed into a comfortable pair of yellow coveralls, so that she still looked every bit the pencil.
She stuck close to Mr. Benedict until he had greeted everyone and taken his chair, after which she swooped upon the platter of toast and eggs, accidentally jostling Rhonda in the process. "Pardon me," she said, embarrassed. "Not at all," said Rhonda. To the children, she said, "Number two is always hungry because she never sleeps. A person needs a great deal of energy to stay awake all the time, and thus a great deal of food." "It also makes me somewhat nervous and irritable, I'm afraid," said number two. She proceeded to eat the crusts off her toast by turning it round and round and taking tiny, rapid bites. "You never sleep?" Kate asked, after watching this curious procedure a moment. Number two swallowed. "Oh, yes, I do, but only a little."
"Don't we make a fine pair?" said Mr. Benedict, pouring himself a cup of tea. "I can't stay awake, and number two can't go to sleep."
He started to laugh, then cut himself short, apparently not wanting to risk it. "By the way, Rhonda, have you seen my map of the harbor? It appears to have escaped the study." "It drifted by me in the hallway," Rhonda said. "I placed it by the bell under the Swiss book on electron positron accelerators."
"Thank you. Now, children, speaking of the bell, do you all remember where it is? On the second floor landing? If you ever hear that bell ringing, I want you to gather on the landing immediately. It will only be rung in case of emergency, so don't delay. Drop what you're doing and go there at once. Understood?" The children nodded uneasily. All this talk of danger and emergencies, without explanation, was beginning to wear on them.
"I'm sorry to put you ill at ease," Mr. Benedict said, "and I haven't much to say to comfort you. I can finally offer some answers to your questions, however. Who wishes to begin?" "Yes, Constance."
To the great exasperation of the others, Constance demanded to know why they couldn't have candy for breakfast. Mr. Benedict smiled.
"A fine question. The short answer is that there is no candy presently in the house. Beyond that, the explanation involves a consideration of candy's excellent flavor but low nutritional value. That is to say, why it makes a wonderful treat but a poor meal. Though I suspect you aren't interested in explanations, but simply wish to express your frustration. Is that correct?"
"Maybe," Constance said with a shrug, but she seemed satisfied.
"Other questions?" said Mr. Benedict.
There were, of course, other questions, and all speaking at once. The children asked him to explain his project and why he needed children and what sort of danger they were in. Mr. Benedict set down his teacup.
"Very well. I shall explain everything, and you may listen as you eat your breakfast."
When he began, however, Constance was the only child who continued to eat. The others were unable to concentrate on anything besides his explanation.
"Several years ago," Mr. Benedict said, "in the course of my research on the human brain, it came to my attention that messages were being delivered to people all across the world. Delivered, I should say, quite without their knowledge. It is as if I secretly hid a letter in your pocket, and later you found and read it, not knowing where it came from. In this case, however, the messages were going directly into people's minds, which absorbed them not only without knowing where the messages came from, but without realizing they had received or read anything at all. The messages appear to be in a kind of code," Mr. Benedict continued. "They come across like poetic gibberish. But from early on, I've had reason to believe they're having a powerful effect, a most unfortunate effect, on those who receive them, which is to say, almost everyone. In fact, I believe these messages are the source of the phenomenon commonly known as the emergency, though I admit I don't know to what end. And so I have devoted myself to discovering their ultimate purpose and who it is that sends them. Unfortunately, I've not entirely succeeded."
"But you've learned a great deal,"
protested number two. Certainly I have. I know, for instance, how the messages are being delivered. And what they're sent from, Rhonda said impatiently.
And what the sender is capable of doing, cried number two.
Obviously, Rhonda and number two were worried the children might misjudge Mr. Benedict. Sensing this, he gave an appreciative smile. Yes, my friends, it's true. We do know some things. For instance, we know the sender uses children to deliver the hidden messages.
Children? Sticky said. Why children?
And what exactly do the messages say? Rainey asked. When you're quite finished with your breakfast, I'll show you. In the meantime, let me tell you.
Please, can't breakfast wait? Kate interrupted. Let us see right now.
Well, if you all feel this way, said Mr. Benedict, noting their looks of impatience. This time, not even Constance resisted, perhaps because she was already full. And so the children were taken straight away up to the third floor, down a long, narrow hallway, and at last into a room packed with equipment. It was a terrific mess. On a table against the wall sat a television, a radio, and a computer, and upon every other available surface were scattered countless tools, wires, books, charts, notebooks, disconnected antennas, disassembled gadgets, and various other unrecognizable oddments. There was hardly anywhere to step as Mr. Benedict, closely attended by Rhonda and number two, led them over to the television. Listen carefully, Mr. Benedict said, turning on the television. Instantly, Rainey felt his skin crawl. It was a familiar feeling, he realized, but he had never paid it much attention before. Meanwhile, a news program had appeared on the screen. A red-haired reporter with shiny gold earrings stood outside the White House, where a crowd of people had gathered, as usual, to wave signs and demand something be done about the emergency.
"They're calling for change," said the reporter,
her features gathered in an expression of thoughtful seriousness.
"And their cries are falling on deaf ears. The president has repeated his agreement that something must be done, and soon. Meanwhile, in the halls of Congress..."
Constance gave a loud yawn.
"I don't hear anything unusual."
The other children looked at Mr. Benedict. It was rude of Constance to say it that way, but she was right. Mr. Benedict nodded.
"Now, pay attention, please. Number two, engage the receiver."
Number two sat at the computer and with quick, agile fingers typed a string of commands. The television screen flickered. Its picture grew distorted. The children could still make out the wavery image of the news reporter gesturing toward the crowd behind her. But her voice faded away, replaced by that of a child.
"What in the world?" Kate said.
"Just listen," said number two. The unseen child, it sounded like a girl about Kate's age, spoke in a plodding, whispery monotone, her voice half-drowned in static. At first, only a few random words were clear enough to be understood.
"Market, to, free, to be, obfuscate."
Number two typed more commands into the computer. The interference lessened considerably, and the child's words came clearly now, slipping through the faint static in a slow drone. "The missing aren't missing, they're only departed. All minds keep all thoughts, so like gold, closely guarded." Again, the words were overcome by static. Number two muttered under her breath. Her fingers flew across the keyboard, and the child's slow, whispery voice returned. "Grow the lawn and mow the lawn. Always leave the TV on. Brush your teeth and kill the germs. Poison apples, poison worms." It went on like this. The child's voice never faltered, never ceased, but delivered the curious phrases in an eerie chant-like progression. The news reporter, meanwhile, had vanished from the distorted picture, replaced by a cheerful-looking weather forecaster, but it continued to be the child's voice they heard. Mr. Benedict signaled number two, whose fingers flew over the computer keyboard. The child's voice faded,
the weather forecaster was promising clear skies by afternoon. Mr. Benedict switched off the television. On the blank television screen, the children could suddenly see their reflections. Every one of them was frowning. When they realized this, their faces all adopted looks of surprise, then of intense curiosity.
"What does obfuscate mean?" asked Constance.
Sticky, as if someone had pulled a string in his back, promptly answered,
"To make sound so confused or opaque as to be difficult to perceive, or to otherwise render indistinct."
Constance looked frightened.
"It means to make things muddled," Rainey said.
"Thank you for the dictionary definition, Sticky," said Mr. Benedict. "And thank you, Rainey, for the translation."
He crossed his arms and regarded the children.
"This child's voice is currently being transmitted on every television, radio, and cell phone in the world, which means, of course, it is being absorbed by millions of minds. And yet, although in an important part of every mind, this child's messages are being heard, understood, and taken seriously, in another part, the part that is aware of itself, the messages remain undetected. But this receiver I've invented is capable of detecting and translating them, much as Rainey translated Sticky's definition a moment ago."
"But how could people who speak different languages understand that kid?" Kate asked.
"What about people in Spain?" "The messages transmit in every language. I've tuned the receiver to English, only because that's what we all speak."
"This is too creepy," Sticky said, glancing nervously behind him. "It's like...
"Like having a strange person whisper in your ear while you're asleep," Mr. Benedict suggested.
"Okay, that just made it creepier," Sticky said.
Rainey was shaking his head wonderingly. "How is this happening, Mr. Benedict? These messages, whatever they are, how are they being sent?"
"To put it simply," Mr. Benedict began, "they depend for their mobility upon external agents."
"Mr. Benedict, that's hardly putting it simply," interrupted Rhonda with a significant look at Constance, whose face had darkened with frustration.
"Forgive me, you're quite right. Simply put, the messages ride piggyback on signals. Television, radio, cell phones, all these things make use of invisible signals, and the sender has found a way to take advantage. The messages aren't picky. They will ride on any kind of signal. The sender has discovered how to control the adhesive property of thoughts."
"The what?" asked all the children together.
"The adhesive property of thoughts. That is, the way thoughts are drawn to signals and then stick to them, much as little pieces of metal may be drawn to a magnet. They're attracted to all kinds of signals, even other thoughts."
"So the messages are just thoughts?" Kate said.
"Indeed," Mr. Benedict replied. "Although I wouldn't say just. Thoughts carry a great deal of freight."
"But why does the sender use children to send them?" Rainey asked.
"A devilish trick," said Mr. Benedict. "And a necessary one. You see, only a child's thoughts can be slipped into the mind so secretly. For some reason, they go unnoticed."
"No surprise there," Constance humped. "I've never met a grown-up who believed me capable of thought."
"She's absolutely right," put in number two with a sharp edge in her voice.
"People pay no attention to what children say, much less to what they think."
Rhonda patted number two's shoulder. Number two is a bit testy about this. She was often ignored as a child.
"That doesn't change the truth,"
number two snarled.
"Easy now," said Rhonda. "Only teasing."
"Sorry, blood sugar's low,"
said number two, hastily unwrapping a granola bar.
"At any rate," Mr. Benedict continued, "I believe the sender uses children as a sort of filter. After passing through the minds of children, the messages become virtually undetectable. Where adult thoughts would lumber into the mind like an elephant, children's creep in on cat feet and find a shadowy place to hide."
Nobody notices them at all?
Sticky asked. Oh, some may be vaguely aware of mental activity, Mr. Benedict said. But if so, they attribute the uneasy sensation to something else. They think, perhaps, they've had an original idea, or have drunk too much coffee.
I don't recall ever having felt that way, said Constance. Like something's happening, but I don't know what.
The others shook their heads, indicating they hadn't either. That is because you love the truth, said Mr. Benedict. You see, number two interrupted him.
Mr. Benedict, before you go on, won't you take a seat? Makes me so nervous, you standing there like that. Too many hard things about. Just look at this chair and the desk and the television cabinet and all these tools.
Turning this way and that, number two was pointing at almost everything she saw.
Fine, fine. Number two, we'll all sit, said Mr. Benedict, settling into a cross-legged position on the floor. He gestured for the others to join him. Shoving aside books, papers, and odd pieces of machinery, the children made room to sit. Number two took a deep breath to calm herself.
You see, Mr. Benedict began again. Although most people care about the truth, they can, nonetheless, under certain circumstances and given proper persuasion, be diverted from it. Some, however, possess an unusually powerful love of truth, and you children are among the few. Your minds have been resisting the hidden messages.
Is that why your test asked whether we liked television and radio?
Asked Rainey. Mr. Benedict tapped his nose.
Exactly. Of course, it's possible you enjoy watching an occasional TV show or listening to the radio every now and then, but in general, you find you don't like it. This is because your minds, so unwilling to be deceived, are avoiding exposure to the messages.
I don't see what's dangerous about all this, Constance said with a sour expression. So people are receiving some kids' thoughts and don't realize it. That hardly seems reason to panic.
We haven't come to the panic part, replied Mr. Benedict gravely.
Oh, said Constance.
Great,
said Sticky.
Something is approaching, Mr. Benedict said. Something dreadful. These messages are connected to it, but they are only the beginning. What's coming is worse, far worse. A looming darkness, like storm clouds, sweeping in to cover the sky.
What?
Sticky stammered.
What is it?
Mr. Benedict scratched his rumpled head.
I'm afraid I don't know.
The children blinked.
Was he joking? He didn't know? Ah, I sense your confusion, said Mr. Benedict. I should have said I don't exactly know.
Rhonda spoke up.
We have good reason to believe in this coming threat, children. It's just that... But if you have good reason, Constance interrupted, why are you just sitting around? Call the government. Alert the authorities.
An excellent point, Constance, said Mr. Benedict, who, it seemed to Rainey, was surprisingly tolerant of the girl's rudeness.
In fact, I was once a trusted advisor to certain high officials, many of whom presided over government agencies. But things have changed. Not only have those agencies been dismantled and a number of good men and women gone missing, but officials formerly attentive to my remarks have grown skeptical of them. They have come to look upon me as a friendly kook, and some even regard me with suspicion. Everything I do now, I do in secret.
Did you just say good men and women gone missing?
Asked Rainey, hoping he had misunderstood.
Vanished, said Mr. Benedict grimly. Years ago, when it first came to my attention that some operatives had disappeared, I naturally inquired about them. But my questions, no matter to whom I put them, and I put them to many people, were met with an astonishing lack of regard. It was perfectly silly, I was told, to be asking such questions. Somehow it was believed that these missing agents chose to go away, were given plum assignments in sunny climates, perhaps, or else had gone into early retirement, although there was no evidence of any such thing. No one seemed to care where the agents had gone. But everyone knew, so I was told again and again, everyone knew the agents hadn't gone missing. No, no, the idea was preposterous. The children were dumbstruck. Government agents had disappeared and nobody cared? Nobody even believed it? Rainey found his voice first.
So that's how you know these strange messages are having an effect on people.
Mr. Benedict nodded. Quite right, Rainey. At least it's one example.
Wait a minute, Kate said. How do you know the messages have anything to do with that?
Because of that phrase we heard on the receiver, said Rainey. The missing aren't missing. They're only departed. Don't you think there's a connection?
Hey, you're right, said Kate, who had already forgotten that phrase. Constance seemed exasperated.
Okay, so the authorities are being snookered by these hidden messages. But how could they resist the facts? Show them your receiver gizmo, Mr. Benedict. They'll have to believe you.
I'm afraid they won't, said Mr. Benedict. The receiver would be considered insufficient evidence. For all they know, the messages might be my own invention, generated by the receiver itself. I am no longer considered a trustworthy source of information.
Rainey was puzzled.
But Mr. Benedict, if you explained how it worked, scientifically, I mean, how could they not believe you? Surely you can demonstrate the principles involved.
Mr. Benedict hesitated. A reasonable suggestion, Rainey. A very... Now let me see. How to put it? I can't exactly... Well...
Number two interrupted him.
What Mr. Benedict is too embarrassed to say, children, is that even if he did explain it, no one would believe him, because no one would understand him. That's the downside to being a genius. Just because you understand something doesn't mean anyone else will. Mr. Benedict is too modest. He can never bring himself to say it.
He's tried to explain it to any number of people, Rhonda put in. But not only are they skeptical to begin with, number two and I, and a few of the other assistants, are the only people who have understood him.
Mr. Benedict's cheeks and forehead had gone pink with embarrassment. He coughed. As usual, my friends, you overstate my accomplishment. Nevertheless, the essence of what you say is true. Among the authorities these days, it is difficult to find a sympathetic listener. In other words, compared to you, they're all dummies, Kate said with a laugh.
That is perhaps not the most polite way to put it, Kate, said Mr. Benedict.
Unlike Kate, the others were in no mood to laugh. Hidden messages being broadcast to the world, good men and women gone missing, the authorities beyond convincing, and the children were somehow going to be involved in all this? The prospect had caused a deep, indefinable dread to settle upon them like a cold mist. Constance's reaction, by now a predictable one, was to express irritation.
Fine, I get it. A lot of people have vanished without a trace, and someone's sending out secret messages, and nobody will believe you about it. But we aren't really in danger, are we?
Though her tone was scoffing and irritable, it was evident from her eyes, which darted back and forth, that Constance was growing afraid.
You said we were all in danger, but that was just an exaggeration, wasn't it?
I am sorry to say it, Constance, Mr. Benedict said somberly, but I did not exaggerate in the least. You are all in danger, even as we speak.
And indeed, even as they spoke, the bell on the landing began a furious clanging.